Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's University. And I'm here again with my colleague and co-director of the center, Mark DiGirolami, for another episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on issues and cases in law and religion. Well, today we have a special guest with us. It's Professor Jed Adkins from Duke University. Jed teaches in the classics department with a specialty in the world of the early Christians and also Roman and Greek political thought. And Jed kindly participated in our colloquium in law and religion this semester. And so we've invited him on to share with you what he shared with us, which is his work on religious liberty among the early Christian thinkers, including especially Tertullian and Augustine, but there are a lot of other thinkers involved too. So first, Mark, hi to you. Welcome back.
So good to see you, Mark, and welcome, Professor Adkins. Wonderful to have you.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here. I really enjoyed meeting with you and your students a few weeks ago, and I'm delighted to be back and to be able to continue our conversation today.
Great. Well, thank you, Jed. So Jed, let's begin with an introduction to our listeners who don't necessarily know that much about the world of the early Christians. So your work is on early Christian political thought, especially with respect to Christian thought on religious liberty. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's absolutely. I've been doing increasing work on thinking about early Christian arguments for religious liberty and more broadly tolerance.
Right, and that, as we were saying in our colloquium, that's kind of a revisionist or subversive view, right, Jed? Because most people, when they think about Christian political thought, they don't think about Christian political thought in favor of religious tolerance. Quite the opposite. Now, this is, you know, probably just the Enlightenment view which we've all inherited, but I think it's fair to say that your work challenges that view.
That's right. The traditional view is Enlightenment view that argues that the idea of religious tolerance came out of the Enlightenment. It came out of a frustration with religious wars, and it was anchored in a type of skepticism and sort of Enlightenment commitment to reason and individual freedom. And in this point of view, Christianity is is a problem. And there's an old view that goes back to David Hume, and Hume argued that monotheism is inherently intolerant and polytheism is inherently tolerant. And so the problem, Christianity isn't the solution, but is actually the problem. And I think just as a general point, I think Hume is absolutely wrong. I think if you look to the ancient world, you see instances of polytheism intolerant. An example that many of our listeners may know is the trial of Socrates. And what we may forget is that part of the charge against Socrates that put him to death by the Athenian people was not worshiping the gods of the city and introducing other gods.
Yeah, well, I think that Hume has gotten his comeuppance recently, hasn't he? Didn't they just take his name off a building at the university in Edinburgh?
But I don't think Jed had anything to do with that, though. It wasn't for these particular reasons, I don't think, that he got into hot water. But actually, Jed, while we're talking, and we should mention this project that Jed came to speak with us about as part of a larger book project that will be in the works for the next a couple of years, and that will be that we will be greatly anticipating. But it's continuous, your methodological take here with your other book, your first book, which actually I have right in front of me right now on Roman political thought, which challenges some of the sort of, I would say, Republican influenced ways of thinking. On my other side, I've actually got Quentin Skinner, who's done something similar with Renaissance thought. But that's your methodological commitments here are continuous with the first book. Would you say that that's right, Jed?
Yeah, that's right. And the Roman political thought book builds on an earlier book, actually on Cicero's political theory as well, that came out in 2013 with Cambridge. But I have actually a paperback version that just came out in May that's affordable, actually, for a Cambridge book, $25 or so for the paperback. So this builds on larger, longstanding commitments. And look, I mean, I think that You know, when you do the history of political thought, I think one of the great advantages of it is you can use the past to open up a critical perspective on the present, to remind ourselves of truths maybe that we've forgotten, or to even open up new ways of thinking, and can be very productive for that. And so that's what I try to do in the book. And I argue that one sort of line of thought that's been left out from contemporary Republican thought is actually the important contribution that Christianity has. So, for instance, Tertullian, who I spoke to your students about, was somebody who he was a lay person born sometime around 155 to maybe died around 240. His dates are always approximate. And Tertullian was somebody who was trained in liberal arts, very traditional education in North African Carthage and in the Roman liberal arts, was experienced in Roman law. There's a big debate about whether he was a lawyer or not. But even if he wasn't a professional lawyer, he was trained in Roman law. He read his Cicero, read Cicero really, really well. But he was also, as a Christian, somebody who deeply reflected on the writings, the New Testament writings of St. Paul and his thinking about conscience. And so Tertullian's great contribution is pulling some of these traditions together. So he thought about the importance of the New Testament importance of conscience, and in particular the ability that we should be free to act on our consciences and live that out, especially as we're convicted about how we should worship God. On the other hand, he thinks about this Republican idea of non-domination, that Cicero actually was somebody that is an important source on that, and this idea that freedom requires that we be protected from and free from the arbitrary will of somebody else. And traditionally, Roman law had the understanding that rights, citizens' rights, and very clear legal procedures are the antidote to arbitrary will that takes away our freedom. And so Tertullian combines these traditions, the religious tradition coming from the New Testament and St. Paul, from Roman political thought, Cicero and Roman law, to come up with a way of freedom, that if we're really going to be free, we need to apply this concept to religion as well and be non-dominated in the sphere of our religious worship and practice.
So it's very interesting, Jed. What you're saying is that Tertullian was sort of adapting Christian teaching to the Roman world. And that is something, if you look just more broadly, that Christianity always does somehow. It always adapts itself somehow to the world in which it finds itself. And so it's really fascinating that with respect to arguments about tolerance, Tertullian was a Roman and was arguing that you Romans need to tolerate us as Christians because we are Roman and this is the Roman tradition. That's really a fascinating point, I think. So now one difference I saw when we talked about Tertullian in our class is that Tertullian is writing specifically about tolerance for Christians as a group. Whereas, you know, nowadays we tend to think of tolerance as, you know, the individual conscience and you know, the dignity of every individual person. So there are some differences in the way Tertullian thought about it and the way we think about it. Yes?
That's right. There's some differences. And you know, I mean, and this is a fascinating way in which Tertullian can actually be a useful corrective, perhaps, of the Enlightenment. You might have a picture of, you know, John Locke. He sees individuals as freestanding who enter and exit societies, as he puts it, as reason and light lead. For Tertullian, there's no such easy sort of entrance and exit costs. We are formed and shaped by our communities. And so even though, and by traditions within those communities. And so even though he does have a concept of individual rights and individual conscience is important, but that conscience is always formed by communities. And that's why he's so keen to argue that that communities need to be protected and the practices within those communities need to be protected. And by the way, it's very interesting that even though he really, as a Christian, has Christianity in mind. At the time, Christians were a vast minority. Only about 2 or 3% of the Roman world at the time would have been Christian. But he also applies it to Judaism. He says Judaism should be a lawful religion. And he also makes the argument that, you know, in some ways, from fairness, that these protections should be applied. The Christians should have this freedom because, for instance, in Egypt, Isis and Osiris worshippers, polytheistic cults in Egypt have the same freedoms.
Well, and can I just continue with that? Because I know that our listeners are thinking this, and I know that our students at St. John's raised this issue, which is, well, okay, so Tertullian, he talks about ISIS and he talks about Judaism, but we all know this is strategic. He wants privileges for his group. It's not about tolerance, it's about Christianity. And as soon as the Christians had the upper hand, then they forgot all about tolerance. And now this may just be the residue of the Enlightenment, that we all think like this now. But how would you respond to that argument? This was just strategic and not really a philosophical commitment to tolerance.
Yeah. Well, I think we can make maybe a distinction between the conditions in which sort of arguments arise and then the principles themselves. So even in the Enlightenment, for instance, on this sort of general theory, there's conditions of persecution that bring about the need to articulate principles. And, you know, I think that's sort of what happened here. So it is strategic, but it's a strategic realizing that we need to have principles of tolerance that we can then apply evenly. And then these principles get taken up so I think we should need to continue the historical story a little bit to show that that these are principles that were able to be taken out of the immediate context. So for instance, Tertullian's thought gets taken up by another Christian rhetor who is actually the professor of rhetoric in the court of Diocletian, and then Constantine, a guy named Lactantius. And then Lactantius's thought, this idea that you should have the right to worship according to your will, this kind of freedom of religion, gets put into the Edict of Milan by Constantine after he converted to Christianity in 212. And then in the Edict of Milan, it's technically, it's not an edict, so it's a misnomer, but he and Licinius, a pagan bishop, came together and the other emperor who was a practitioner of Roman polytheism came together and they agreed on this, which is kind of interesting. I think another thing that's fascinating is you begin to see in the fourth century, you begin to see actually pagans like Symmachus, for instance, beginning to cite these same arguments back against the Christians as Christians begin to get in greater power. So I think this is a fascinating sort of case because you can see that you can have principles that then can be generalizable and can, even though they may have begun to be forged to protect your own group, can begin to be abstracted to hold for all groups. And, you know, if you really wanted to go back to somebody where Christians begin to go wrong, and I think you're absolutely right, you know, that the history of the church is one that, you know, is at times not pretty. And so there are examples of Christian persecution of pagans, particularly after Christianity became the state religion in 384 by Theodosius. But on the same time, you can go back and you can say that same desire for fairness for all that Tertullian enunciated as a basic condition of freedom, Christians need to be bound by that as well. So I think, there's space within the Christian tradition to actually remedy Christian intolerance when it has sadly come up.
Jed, could you give our listeners a sense of because the idea of tolerance as non-domination is very important with respect to your reconstruction of Tertullian's thought. And that idea, religious freedom and toleration is very much in the news today. It's very much a part of the American legal scene, but it seems to me it's quite different. And we've already talked about one difference with respect to the communal individual quality here, but there are also substantive differences, it seems to me, between these notions of religious toleration.
Yeah, no, that's right. And increasingly, I teach a course on liberty and equality to my first years at Duke. And it's, you know, we begin with the Greeks and go all the way to contemporary debates. And of course, we talk about these issues. And increasingly, you know, my students have a view that tolerance is not about this notion of tolerance that I'm defending, a notion that involves objection and restraint. The idea of tolerance requires, on this sort of traditional view that I would argue the early Christians accept, this view that there's something that I think is wrong and harmful. And also, I could be in a position to take action against it. But because of some reason, some commitment that I have, I restrain myself. So tolerance requires both objection and restraint. And it's about forbearing when you see something that's wrong, and maybe even things that you recognize would be harmful or might even be a case of injustice. And increasingly, my students have a view that, that tolerance actually requires you to a type of affirmation, and it might even require taking action you know, against views that are disapproved in order to promote those that you think are oppressed. And so so it might actually be consistent with a sort of a view of punishment. And so one of the things I think is fascinating in this early Christian tradition is it actually speaks to, I mean, one thing that I affirm in my students is like they have a great desire for justice. And I think that's a healthy thing and a good thing. But one of the things that I find that's really interesting about this early tradition is that they actually connect the need for justice, and in particular, the need for judgment, with a notion of tolerance. And so these two things go together. And so it invites us into thinking hard about what are the preconditions for judgment and what are the limits of judgment. And only when we have done that sort of thinking and critical thought can we open ourselves up to tolerance. So what I want to say to my students is when you raise these sort of objections about justice, I say, well, that's right. But now let's think more about when we should judge and when we should not judge, and then let's think more about the conditions for plurality that these acts require.
Yeah, Jed, and I'm curious, how do your students respond to that?
Well, they love it. I mean, I think increasingly we have a society where our students have lost, they're not familiar with this tradition. And so there's openness for us, a type of surprise, I think, and which leads to conversation. So one thing that they find, very interesting is this notion that for judgment to take place and for tolerance to take place, we need to realize that as human beings, we're creatures that are bound by both space and time. So justice matters, and so that's important. But also the fact that the judgments that we make in our aspirations for justice also have to take into account that we live in time and that we have a past and we have a future as well. And so this becomes important because this early Christian tradition points out that if we judge without remembering we have a past and a future, the judgment that will come about will mean that our space is a pure space and there's no room for disagreement. There's no room for dissent. And there's also no room for growth. And this is very important for my students who are learning and trying to figure things out. And they realize that they're going to make mistakes and that they're going to err. So they realize that, that there's a cost if you think about judgment in a way that eliminates the past and eliminates the future. And of course, you all are interested in, being in a law school or interested in law. And I think one thing that's very interesting with this early Christian tradition, when you bring time into the account of judgment, is somebody like Augustine, when he connects judgment to time, recognizes that we need to have a statute of limitations, for instance. There can be things in the past that you can't be dredged up against you again. And at the same time, you can't have double jeopardy. You can't be, once judgment happens and sets you free, you can't be held accountable again for your past crimes. And the logic is very interesting because that's a situation of arbitrariness, actually, when you can be condemned again for things that have happened in the past which sets you unfree. So there's a lot of resources here, I think, that we can draw on in this earlier tradition that our students find very, very, very valuable and relevant.
So it's very interesting, Jed. And one question I have about this is why you think that there has been a revival of interest in the patristics and in this early Christian thought. We had a couple of years ago Bob Wilkin, who came and talked to us about his new book, Liberty and the Things of God. And he too, of course, he's been at this for a long time, and he's a renowned scholar of the period. But it does seem to me that so you've got you and Bob,
Steve Smith
also, book. That's right. Yeah, that's right. That there's been a kind of reawakening of interest in studying this period, particularly now in the America of today. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I do. I think partly it has to do with, I think a felt correspondence between the realities of the late ancient Roman world and where we are today. Of course, You know, another book I'd throw into the mix that even though it doesn't address Christian thought would be, you know, Patrick Deneen's Why Liberalism Failed, which, you know, came out as an immediate bestseller. And so, you know, and you know, the sense is that there's maybe the compact on which American society is held together is unraveling. And so there's a great uncertainty and a series of crises, I think a crisis of authority and certainly and a crisis of stability. And at the same time, there's a great sense of pluralism within American society as well, competing views in the public sphere. And that those phenomenon really are, I think, are reflected in the Roman world in which these Christian writers are operating. You know, so I'll give you a couple of points. For instance, you know, I mentioned the Edict of Milan, and so that like, this next century that's happening in the third century is a fascinating time. There's a great book, Edward Watts, who's an ancient historian, it's called The Final Pagan Generation, The Last Pagan Generation. And he points out there that you really have the compact among the elite, which and expectations that have held the Roman ruling class together for centuries are unraveling, and they don't have the resources to deal with it. And so they're grappling with how to stay together. And there's all kinds of destabilizing economic and social forces that are taking place at that time. And Christianity actually is, interestingly, maybe one of those. So that's part of it. But the other part then too is just the pluralism. Rome was a deeply pluralistic world, and St. Augustine, who will feature into to my work and my book, although he hasn't come into our conversation yet, is a great example. Those of you who have read the Confessions, you know, he was born in the 350s, died in about 430, and he's living right through this fourth, these destabilizations. You know, is somebody who has, had lots of options on the table, the Catholic Christianity of his mother, Roman polytheism. There's Manichaeanism, which is a philosophy from the East. So just a smorgasbord of options that people were searching through. And then finally, we have the crisis of authority that really gets played out at the end of Augustine's life. He's writing his great work on the City of God, right as, after the sack of Rome. And so a great cataclysmic event. Psychologically, I think, where Romans are feeling that, you know, if we missed it in the fourth century and we felt like Rome could continue by the fifth century, you know, psychologically, they're realizing that their world is coming apart. And so I think these great uncertainties are one reason why people are looking back to the Roman world. Because, yeah, I mean, I think very much there's this sense of uncertainty now with America.
Yeah, I think that's really a very good way to think about it. I think the world of late antiquity is really accessible to us now because in some ways we are in a similar world. That's a really profound point, I think. Well, Jed, before we close, you want to say a couple of words about your next project, what book you're working on now?
Yep. So the book is on the Christian origins of tolerance, and in some ways it picks up a lot of the themes of this conversation. I'm trying to both tell a history of, but also defend a view of tolerance as this notion of objection and restraint. And I want to argue that this idea came about not out of the liberal enlightenment, but out of early Christian reflections on what does it mean to live in pluralistic societies, and a notion of tolerance that requires patience among plurality, and that's also tied up with this idea of judgment, we have to figure out our commitments to judge before we can responsibly say judge not, and you know that we're beings that are situated in both judgment and tolerance. Understand that we're beings that are situated both in space and in time, and so I think it very helpfully this tradition illuminates the preconditions for, you might say, a tolerant judgment or a judgment that's consistent with tolerance. And I think that that's really a space where we need to be thinking about now. And that's one of the things that I find that's just missing in contemporary debates, actually, about tolerance. This notion that, often our debates end up around space You know, if you think about free speech on campus, people, think about safe spaces and deplatforming. It's all about space, judgment in space. But what I want to say is, what happens when you bring time into the equation? What happens when you say these judgments about space are very important judgments that, you know, we have to have these conversations. But we also have to realize that we're beings that live in time, that have a past and a future. And then the last element that I think is very important that comes out of this is a judgment that is consistent with tolerance, also is a judgment that has some kind of notion of the human good or human flourishing, that that punishment should always be, if indeed judgment needs to be made and the authorities need to make a punishment, it needs to look for the good of that person. And again, it's a good that understands that people are living in space and time. So it's not simply about power. We're not just...
So that's a kind of Aristotelian, Ciceronian, natural law inflected, you know, part of the piece. I'm looking forward to that part.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And, you know, there is an account of human flourishing that's there. And, and I think one of the things that I think is very fascinating about this early Christian tradition is they are trying to make these arguments in a Roman society that's very pluralistic. And so one of the things that you always have to negotiate is how thick is going to be your account of human flourishing. How robust it's going to be, because you've got to get people to sign on, and then what kind of arguments can you make for that? But one thing that will never drop out is the notion that there is a human good, and we need that to be able to relate among human beings. That once we reduce our relations to power, mere power dynamics, tolerance becomes impossible. And I will say that my students resonate with this as well, because, you know, in a time of, they're very worried about polarization and tribalism. And so, you know, they on what basis can we get on with other people who disagree with each other? So I think in a way, this work can really be a pleasant surprise. Maybe we can find inspiration in places where in the modern world, we'd never think to look.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jed. That we look forward to reading that. And we want to thank you for being with us, and thank you for being part of the colloquium. So as we say, you know the way, and we hope you'll come back. Meanwhile, for my co-director, Mark DiGirolami, and myself, I want to say thank you again for listening to another episode of Legal Spirits. You can find past episodes and this one archived on our website, lawandreligionforum.org, and also on Apple iTunes. That's all for now. Look forward to joining you again next time.